This is episode 492. Could this conversation give you a natural alternative to Ozempic or any GLP modifier or weight loss drug? Quite possibly. And that's not just a cheesy hook to get you listening. Trust me, you'll want to listen to this whole conversation. It's fascinating. So, what if the reason you're tired, inflamed, gaining weight, got diabetes, what if that has nothing to do with calories and everything to do with one enzyme that hijacks your mitochondria every time you eat fruit or sugar of any kind, or even when you're dehydrated or stressed? Today's guest is a metabolism researcher and expert that introduces us to the fructose model of disease, showing how this could be the root cause to all the big diseases, and most certainly why restrictive diets continually fail for weight loss for so many people, and why managing sugar cravings is always and perpetually so damn challenging. He's here to blow up basically everything you thought you knew about metabolism, and for me as a scientist, I definitely feel like this makes a lot of sense in pulling a lot of big ideas in the world of disease and medicine together, and I'm super excited to share it with my clients and with you today. So let's get into it. Even as a scientist and nutritionist, I was secretly trapped in binge eating and hooked on sugar. And let's be real, the so-called solutions can feel overwhelming. Calorie counting, restrictive diets, weight loss pills, surgery, and even injections. I'm Maddie Lansdowne, and the truth is, more nutrition facts aren't the answer. It's understanding why we eat the way we do. And you don't need to be perfect to achieve great health either. That shift changed everything for me, and now I share it here as the host of the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast, where it's my mission to help 1 million people break free from the yo-yo diet cycle for good, by bringing you the conversations that really matter in nutrition, health, and psychology. And I'm not afraid to challenge mainstream health advice when it doesn't stack up. Are you ready? Let's begin. What's up, my healthy friends? Today's episode is, maybe surprisingly, not just another sugar is bad chat. In fact, we're going to go much deeper, hopefully all the way to the cellular level, with a bit of a metabolic breakdown. So here with me today is Chris Mearns, and a shout out to the homie Lucas Owen at Boost Your Biology for connecting us. So Chris is the founder of some incredible products, which you're going to hear a little bit about today, but it's off the back of what he's dubbed the fructose model of disease, and particularly metabolic disease, which could be the answer for millions and millions of people to getting well again. So this is absolutely worth listening to today because it might challenge a paradigm that's been in place for a long time and be a voice of hope that you haven't heard before. So, Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Maddie. I'm excited to be here. Looking forward to it.
As I mentioned before we hit record, I've been deep in your world without you really knowing. That sounds a bit creepy, but all week just like diving into this, because after our first chat, I sort of was like jumped on the chat and I was like, oh, you know, Lucas sent you my way. I was like, oh, who's Chris? What's he all about? And by the end of it, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I've been fascinated and talking about it ever since. And
So
maybe a good place for us to start is like maybe with what some would dub the most radical claim, but that fructose isn't a fuel, it's a stressor. Let's maybe just like paint the idea or the picture for people of what your idea of fructose is, what it actually is, and how you're sort of flipping things on its head a bit.
Totally. So it seems like most of the research for many, many decades really kind of put fructose aside because it looked at glucose, the other side of sugar. And it basically said, okay, glucose raises insulin. It's our primary fuel system. We've got too much glycogen around. So like, it's a problem. This doesn't take away from any of that, but it's saying like, let's look closer at fructose because maybe it's not inert. Because, And what the latest research shows is that it actually doesn't just result in lipogenesis, like a little bit of new fat creation, de novo lipogenesis, but it actually starts to create a scenario where that is the end result. So it's like a progressive stressor where inside the cell, fructose metabolism itself causes inflammation. It causes reactive oxygen species. It basically generates uric acid so that the mitochondria start crushing down as if they're like a rate limiter almost, where it's like suddenly their capacity for the input of fuel and the output of energy is reduced. And it seems very intentional, where it's like suddenly you basically end up with a stressed, very tired cell. And then because it's in conservation mode, the entire body starts having a reaction. So it's like, it's a deep thing. It goes way past just like the digestion of fructose. It's a very deep level.
Yeah, it's so incredibly fascinating because I think, you know, we often hear like, you know, natural food, whole real food, you know, fruit exists in nature. And a lot of people that then brings up like, oh, but fruit and fructose are a thing. And we encourage babies to have pureed fruit and, you know, lots of glucose and fructose in there. And so it's often a challenging idea. Well, I can imagine it would be a challenging idea for people to be like, so hang on, if fructose is in fruit and fructose is in all of these different foods, then...
And fruit's healthy. Yeah.
Yeah, and fruit's healthy.
So it's definitely challenging. And so that's a major issue because like we're talking biochemistry here where it's like we're not... Like fruit is a very complex food. It's not just... It's not even just sugar. It's not just like glucose and fructose. It is heavy in fructose, yes, but it's packed full of... polyphenols, is packed full of minerals, is packed full of fiber, is packed full of water. And basically, all of that seems to buffer the effects of fructose. So it's like when we're talking fructose, we're taking literally the chemical out and talking about how that behaves in the body. And so when I'm not villainizing fructose, I actually think it's a powerful tool. For especially when you look back through history in the wild, animals would use fruit. Like we probably all know, bears before hibernation will literally binge on fruit. And in doing so, they seem to be able to activate this like underlying mechanism of fructose so that they can pack on weight really heavily and so that they can hibernate. Or maybe another interesting example is hummingbirds. Hummingbirds live on sugar. They go and they eat sugar all day, and their metabolic rate is so crazy that basically that sugar allows them to more or less induce a diabetic state by dusk, and then that allows them to survive night, where by morning they're back to zero, and then they go crazy on their sugar again. So it's like this wild thing where their metabolic rate is so fast that they have to basically crush it to death with diabetes by eating so much sugar. So it's wild. So basically the point is that like, this is not a bad thing. This is a survival mechanism. We just are flooding our bodies with it and we're using it improperly. And so fruit remains healthy because most of the time it's buffered. It's like the fiber makes it slow down in your gut. So it doesn't really pass through the liver very quickly. And if we're eating whole fruit, there's not that much of it. Realistically, if we start drying it, then we eat like, I don't know, 15 apricots in like the course of 10 minutes, or we juice it and suddenly we get rid of all the fiber that buffers that out. And there's literally research that shows that you are more likely to end up with metabolic problems if you eat your fruit whole. So,
yeah, totally. The thing that I'd love to maybe draw out or get you to speak in a more nuanced way about that I think really helped me understand what was going on, and possibly others will feel the same, is like, why does, and we've sort of touched on it, but why does fructose act as a rate limiting step, a reduction in production? I'm not trying to be a rapper, but why does it reduce the energy output of the mitochondria? And what are the side effects or the consequences of that reduction?
Perfect. Okay. So the first step in fructose metabolism is a enzyme called fructokinase or KHK, ketohexokinase C typically. And what that does is it converts fructose into fructose 1-phosphate, and that basically starts to deplete your ATP. So ATP gets degraded into ADP, into AMP, into IMP, and finally, this ends up in a state in uric acid. Mm-hmm. So we're all talking within the cell. We're talking intracellular uric acid here. And what that ends up doing is it causes a little bit of stress. So effectively, it's like a waste product in the cell. So we end up with reactive oxygen species. We have that little bit of inflammation that appears because it's inducing a little bit of stress. And basically, it's like it blunts a little bit of that mitochondrial performance. And so most of the time, you might look at it and say, okay, it's the rapid depletion of ATP that's the problem. Which it is, like you get, that's that sugar low in a way. Like you have sugar and then You have the high very briefly with the glucose, and then you hit the crash with the fructose. That's that little drop in ATP. But it's this kind of slow drip, persistent problem with the mitochondrial stress that makes it progressive, where it's like, if I'm eating too much fructose sources, or I have too much exposure to fructose, like as a child, through my teens, through my 20s, at a certain point, that little drip of problem on my mitochondria is going to basically induce cellular fragility, which then scales into like system fragility, where a cell that is not performing well is fine. It's a problem, but it's not like the biggest problem. Mm-hmm. The body can compensate. But when you have the entire organ that starts to have the same kind of low energy fragility, then it makes a lot of sense that that's where pathology starts coming out. And we start seeing like actual chronic disease emerge. And so because this state, this low energy cell, this stressed, inflammatory, and ultimately insulin resistant cell, it doesn't matter in the body where it is. It's in your vascular system. It's in your liver. It's in your brain with endogenous fructose. So it kind of becomes the common foundational state, from what I can see, of chronic disease, where it's like, this is the first domino to fall. And then later, when we start actually diagnosing things, then we start to see, okay, yeah, that must have happened long ago. But not enough people are paying attention to that fact.
I love that visual of it being the first domino to fall, because that feels, I mean, I know that I'm at the moment coming off a week of like reading and listening to heaps of your stuff. So I feel like that's the bit people need to realize, like, oh my God, we have to tell them. But also to factor in, you know, because obviously maybe the people that disagree with this or have a different perspective, you know, then there's also the factors of like, we don't get enough sunlight, which also impacts metabolic and mitochondrial function. You know, we manage way too much stress, or don't manage stress, you know, which is all excessive cortisol and plus heavy metal toxins. And I was speaking to someone the other day that was talking about, you know, their grandmother or their mother that had gotten lung cancer, but had never smoked a cigarette in her life. And, you know, we've got thousands of chemicals in the air now, especially in cities that we breathe. And so my question is, like, with, we're speaking obviously about fructose functionally, and what I mean by that is, I guess, dietarily, how is the impact of fructose metabolism and or mitochondrial function also impeded by those other factors?
That's a really important question. So basically, you're right, like mitochondria have many different influencers. I mean, even thyroid is another one, or genetic problems where it's like we simply have... we're born with a certain like deficiency in certain ways that eventually in influences the performance of our mitochondria. So what I actually see here is that this is not the only cause. This is simply saying that it's that failure inside this inside the cell of the cellular energy that is effectively cascading into chronic disease. And so fructose itself is simply the most modifiable one. And probably the one where we screwed up our health the most with modern diets. And it's like, it's like, of course, I don't know, toxin, like seed oils or whatever might happen to be there. There's so many different things that are a problem, and I'm not invalidating any of that. It's just simply saying that I think fructose is the villain under the hood that we've just been missing this whole time. It's been too quiet. And I think it's probably the biggest stressor, because I don't know if you want to go here, but even looking back through history at the development of how we modified our diet, it's like it fits in lockstep of everything that kind of changed.
So. Yeah. Yeah, no. I'm happy to go anywhere, by the way. We can talk about the most controversial things you ever want to speak about.
Well, I love this. I love this one because it's so weird. So like, and no one expects us to go here. So The East India Trading Company had a monopoly on sugar for ages. And essentially in the 1850s, that kind of collapsed with some tariffs on sugar and the introduction kind of sugar to the world at the London World Fair in like 1851. And basically from that moment, if you look at a chart of like the world's consumption of sugar, It's like it's flat, or specifically fructose, but sugar, basically. It's flat. Like, people couldn't afford it. And so prior to that, it's like everyone, we heard of gout, but it was like the very wealthy. This was the elite class that could have, they could eat anything they wanted. And then suddenly, when that changed in 1851, it absolutely spikes, where as we started eating more and more sugar per year, metabolic decline followed. And it was like maybe a 10 to 15 year lag where it's like all of a sudden people start getting sick. And then it's crazy because over the next, I mean, that was 175 years ago now. So basically from then on, we started radicalizing our diet with everything we could possibly eat because trade improved and everything else. So then like we invented supermarkets in like the early 1900s. I think the Piggly Wiggly was the first one, where suddenly you could kind of, instead of going to like the different artisans, you'd go to like sort of a little supermarket and kind of buy everything you want. Mm-hmm. And then processed food started introducing into there. And then, of course, we know high fructose corn syrup started in like the late 1960s or something like that. And basically, it became to the point where instead of sugar being for the wealthy, now it's only the poor that can really, like, they survive on cheap food, on processed, cheap, sugary foods. And so even looking at the demographics of like minority groups seemingly being more prone to metabolic problems because they simply don't have as much advantage, like it's crazy how everything kind of just fits. And it's unfortunately, of course, there's other things. And I do believe that fructose is just the amplifier, but it fits where it's like basically we tipped our mitochondria into a state of dysfunction by adding this extra stress to it. So before, maybe it was just only genetic and I could deal with it. But now when I'm eating sugar every single day, it's like it's tipping that little bit of mitochondrial stress past the limit where all of a sudden disease emerges.
Mm. It's something I think about as you talk there, like is what we spoke about last time, which is this idea that, And the bears are a perfect example of, you know, they binge eat fruit, so massive volumes of, you know, of sugar and fructose into their system. And in the Western world, we're doing this with, you know, junk food and a lot of things that are in a box, a bag or a can. And so the idea that makes sense for me, or the little phrase that I was like, oh, this kind of wraps it up. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it felt like the idea is that we rate limit the mitochondrial output because the warmer weather produces fructose-rich food. We binge eat the fructose-rich food to store excess body fat to survive a dark, cold winter where food is less accessible. And so it's kind of like we're all eating for winter, but nobody ever experiences winter. Is that an accurate summation or?
That is bang on. That is bang on. So if you look at how fructose is accessed, if it's a food source, it's typically, you're right, like late in summer, right before scarcity of winter, where it's like food is the most abundant. And so you'll want to eat it and you want as much of that to pack on because fat is going to help you survive the winter. So it's like, it's this little bit of a fat storage aid. It's like, it's a conservation signal to your body that I want to conserve as much as possible. And so if you flip that, it's not just abundance that makes this switch on, but it's also scarcity that makes this switch on. So it's like now in winter, I don't have access to water as well. I don't have access to food as well. And so there will also be a switch that happens because the stresses that our body faces and the endogenous ways that our body actually makes fructose kind of flips it the other way, where it's like, because times are scarce, we're going to conserve so that we don't waste so much. And so that's the other side of this picture. And that's probably where people trip up a lot because they don't realize, because really we've only known this very briefly, but that sugar is not just, or that fructose is not just from sugar or from fruit. It is from, the body produces it with a pathway called the polyol pathway, where glucose is converted into sorbitol, and then sorbitol is converted into fructose.
And what's the function of that pathway? Like, why does that happen?
Well, if you think of it, so an excessive, so the real, the trigger is that you have a high blood glucose level. Mm-hmm. So if your mitochondria aren't, so let's think of it logically. So if your mitochondria can't access that stuff because they're maxed out, essentially, then the body is likely to try to store that for later. So mm-hmm. then it'll be converted into fat. But yep. it also makes sense that it's like, it would signal the body to say, we're in a conservation mode. Like we've got more than we need. So let's rate limit that mitochondria signal again so that we can push more and more of that abundance into fat for later. So basically it's like, and then the process is the same because that the glucose then gets shuttled into fructose and then it gets metabolized so that the mitochondria get kind of downregulated again.
So I got a question off the back of that. So the polyol pathway that you're just describing, is that mechanism or is that pathway triggered as a result of leptin signaling? Like, or
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I don't.
Yeah, I'm just trying to build the picture in my mind of it all being connected.
Yeah, totally. I can't remember reading that there's a connection there. But I mean, if we're talking about like cravings and stuff like that, I think there a part that I didn't mention is that if you have a low energy cell, then it makes sense that the body will signal that there's a starvation problem. Mm-hmm. Because it's basically running on fumes. And so there is documentation that says that leptin and ghrelin are influenced by that state where basically we eat that sugar, we downregulate our energy cell, our cellular energy, and then it triggers cravings so that we go and we eat more fructose and then the whole thing becomes a loop. So I didn't really talk about that earlier, but there is like very much, it kind of makes sense why so many of the foods that we like to eat trace back to this because it's almost like that was the purpose where it was like, of course, biologically, we will want to eat the foods that will give us the best chance of survival. Those will be, that's where our taste develops. And so it maps out that way. Sweet is, of course, fructose, but also carbs. So like high glycemic carbs, as we just said. And then salty foods, because the high osmolality with your, basically the saltiness of our blood is a signal as well to store, to activate the polyol pathway. So to get that more fructose generating. So salty foods map into it. Umami foods are high in uric acid. So they kind of just bypass that whole process and they become like, they feed the entire system by causing that cellular stress with high uric acid. And then alcohol as well. So alcohol is an interesting one because so when you take a piece of fruit, when it is unripe, it is really high in fiber. It has very little fructose at that point. It's dull in color. It's not attractive and we don't really want to eat it. We can hardly digest them. Mm-hmm. But as it ripens, basically all those signals fall off. So it's like, why is it ripening? It's ripening because the plant wants to distribute its seeds. It wants you as the animal to eat it. So then it makes sense that it would brighten the colors. It would make it sweeter. It would reduce those protective fibers. And then we'll go and eat it. If you take that to the extreme end, then you end up with fermentation. And you end up with ethanol. And then it makes sense why then alcohol would also stimulate the same pathway. Where it's like if you ate that half-rotten fruit, if you drink alcohol, then you're going to actually stimulate the same pathway. And it's crazy. Just yesterday, there was a paper published that properly mapped out that alcohol causes endogenous production of fructose.
Yeah.
And so like it's kind of been part of this map the whole time, but now it's been like mechanistically determined that yes, primarily because of osmolality. So it reduces, it like causes dehydration. So because of that, then your body is stimulated to create fructose. So it's like all of these different things, all the things we like to eat, everything that feels like a cheat maps back to fructose. It's crazy.
It really is crazy. But we mentioned before, like the first domino to fall is that sort of rate limiting step in the possible, you know, high inflammation disease outcomes, is that rate limiting step in the mitochondria as a result of fructose or fructokinase signaling. My next question is whether it's the second domino or third. You mentioned in there insulin resistance. Now, often when people are talking about obesity, weight gain, blood sugar issues, they start with blood sugar. And then even some people with, you know, plenty of body fat have actually stable blood sugar only to discover that they've got insulin dysregulation and resistance. So yeah. Which domino is the insulin resistance and how does that play a part in this story?
That's a great question. So like you said, like we all know that inflammation is a problem. Inflammation's good until it becomes a problem. Even reactive oxygen is only temporarily a problem. A lot of this stuff is really cool how it starts as an adaptation, then it becomes maladaptive because we left it on too long. And so I believe that insulin resistance is the same thing. And there's been some theories on this for quite a few years now, where basically you ask the question of if your cells are resisting the delivery of fuel, then why? Mm-hmm. And it makes sense now, if you think of the mitochondria being that bottleneck, it's like it literally can't process it. And so what would happen if I delivered glucose successfully to that cell is it would basically create too much substrate in the cell and it would cause more oxidative stress. So it makes sense why it's like it slams the door shut and says, I can't use any more fuel, and starts pushing back a little bit. That makes sense from a logical standpoint.
Yeah, makes sense to me, yeah. I feel like it also begins to explain overeating.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, and that's based, so if we think of like the mitochondria as that bottleneck where it's like we've got too much fuel starting to pile up on this side and only a drip out of energy, then that emergency signal just keeps telling you fuel up as much as you can because we're starving. And as long as that is pinched, then that signal is going to keep happening. So we end up overfeeding, and we can overfeed because we've like influenced our satiety with leptin. And then it's like it becomes that self-reinforcing problem.
Yeah, it's like as a little phrase is coming to mind that, you know, we're overfed but undernourished.
Yes. And that's the paradox at the heart of this is it's like, why am I chronically fatigued and yet always hungry and overweight? It's like it doesn't map out. It's like if food is fuel, then what is going on? Like there's something wrong. And it makes sense why it's like on the very smallest level that it's like the engine itself should be the problem. Like I've used this metaphor of a car before where it's like we blame too much glucose, and it's like in a car that would be akin to saying my fuel tank is too full. Which sounds crazy. I mean, it's like not, that shouldn't really be the problem. Or if we blame insulin resistance, then it's saying like the gas pedal isn't working because I'm signaling that I want to put fuel into my engine and it's resisting it. So there's something wrong with my gas pedal. But really, like we all kind of, even if we know nothing about the car, it's like the logical thing is that there's something wrong with the engine if it's not performing well. And so that really is, that's what the mitochondria's role is. It is our little tiny engines.
I'm curious, and this might be a side tangent or maybe a place we don't go, but let me know. But I'm curious, if this is the case, then how does that map onto the conversation around diabetes? Because we mentioned insulin. So if we look at people that are just given more insulin to cope with the volume of, you know, sugar that they're putting in, like, you know, that sort of the thing that's coming up in my brain at the moment is that those interventions could essentially backfire. And I also say that from experience because I work with heaps of people that use insulin and haven't solved their problems yet.
Yeah. And I think that's really the thing is like, unless you solve the engine problem, you're kind of band-aiding it. And so like I think GLP-1s, like just to, not to change the subject, but I think GLP-1s are fantastic. They're an amazing progress. But I'm looking at it and I'm honestly like, not surprised at all by all the off-label stuff happening, because from this model, it's like saying, okay, I have too much weight. I need to lose weight. So I'm going to decouple that fuel tank that my little tiny eco car is trying to drag around. It's cutting, it's like forced starvation almost, because it's like influencing your satiety to this point where it's like, I just can't eat anymore, which is great. I mean, it's taking the load off, but is it solving the real problem under the hood? No. Because, and that's really what we're seeing is like people go, so it's getting the burden off of it. And that's fantastic. It's helping. But when they go off of it, then they still see those metabolic problems and they don't feel great. Like it's not like, it's not like taking Ozempic, you feel amazing for the rest of your life. Most of the time there's, you don't feel awesome. But at this, that said, I am super excited because it is helping millions and millions of people. You know, what's interesting about this is that one of the fructokinase inhibitors that we were looking at to kind of help this whole process, the first place, and I've only recently realized this, I thought I was always focused on like the liver and downstream after after digestion. But it turns out that there's been kind of a confusion when it comes to gluten intolerance. Like apparently 80% of people that think that they're gluten intolerant are not. And what's actually happening there is FODMAPs, like there's fermentation in the gut, and that's, and the body can't handle that. And so that is the source of it. So then what are FODMAPs? Most of them, when it comes to wheat, are fructans, which are like little chains of fructose. And so as the gut breaks those down, it's metabolized within your gut lining, and it causes the same mitochondrial stress. So your gut lining gets more fragile. And as it gets more fragile, it becomes more and more like it can't handle the pressure of all of those fermented foods that start, those foods that start fermenting in your gut. And what's really interesting is I just only learned yesterday is that that also influences your body's ability to secrete GLP-1. In your gut. And so your own natural GLP-1 is blunted by the fact that we're eating too much of these like stresses of like sugar in our gut.
Oh, it's so fascinating. It's like
it all connects. Yeah,
it really does. Well, and it also, just as you described, I think for the, you know, there are also people that take GLP-1s and don't see a result. There are many people that don't feel great, like you described. And I think that leans into a little bit of that conversation of overfed and undernourished, because if it's forced starvation and your mitochondria isn't supplying the energy that the system needs, and now you're putting yourself in a state of starvation without fixing the energy, you know, the rate limiting step of the mitochondria, then now you're just even further undernourished.
Totally. So I'm on some communities online, and it's interesting. There's a community that has like hardline sugar to say, I'm not going to eat it. And they completely cut it out of their diet, and half of them can't make it like 3 days. And it's crazy. So what happens there, if you think of it, is like sugar is both fuel and fuel regulator. So if in an effort to get rid of that fuel blunting problem, the mitochondrial problem, we get rid of the fuel, then suddenly we're increasing the starvation problem in the short term before we get the chance to recover from it. It's like the mitochondria can't improve fast enough with that lack of glucose. So then when people's like say, okay, I'm gonna cut sugar out, but then they add more complex carbohydrates, then it gets much easier. When they add a little bit of MCT oil to like deliver ketones to those starving cells, then that kind of helps as like a break glass thing where it's like, okay, I'm okay now, I can handle this. And it's like, so it's like restriction is a really hard way to handle this problem, unfortunately. It's an important thing, but it's not a world-changing solution. Because if alcohol, if high glycemic carbs are the problem, if savory foods, umami foods are the problem, if salty foods are the problem, it's like if everything we like to eat maps to this, then what does a restrictive diet look like? It's messy. And not only that, but we didn't talk about this, but hypoxia, dehydration, and basically like high cortisol, like stresses on the body also trigger the body to create fructose. So if someone becomes obese, then suddenly they have chronic dehydration. And because their glycogen stores are basically pulling all the water out of their body. And then as that weight kind of starts crushing on their chest, they don't sleep as well. They start getting sleep apnea, and that is now hypoxia. So even if you don't change, even if you like don't look at diet just from that perspective, you become a self-reinforcing kind of problem where your body's always making fructose and making the problem worse.
Because you're listening here, I can safely assume you're an absolute legend. And so if you want to keep this party going, I'd love to invite you over to follow me on Instagram or YouTube, both under the same name of The Real Weight Loss Coach. Over there, you'll find different content in both places. It's different. So heaps of bite-sized pieces of information. So if you want to learn lots of things really fast with a bit of a scroll, or simply you just prefer some visuals, then scroll over to The Real Weight Loss Coach on Instagram and YouTube. So see you there. Thank you. And let's get back into the episode. Yeah, I mean, for anybody that listens to this show, they've either been trying to lose weight for a very long time, or at least know several people that have got weight challenges. And the restriction model, you know, I've been revolting against the restriction model of dieting for a long time because I'm yet to meet many people. It's like a less than 1% probably. It's a random statistic, but of people that actually can do white knuckle willpower forever, for the rest of ever, because it's essentially
and
like working
heroes. It's like, good for you, but the rest of us.
Yeah, we wish we could be like them, you know? Like,
right.
But, and I've been revolting against that for a long time because I'm like, you know, either our psychology is manipulated by advertising and marketing and simply being in a high sugar state. And I guess the reason that I bring that up is because I'm curious with those other factors, like the dehydration, the salt, you know, the stress in the nervous system. What do you feel is the reason for the fructose production? So if we're reducing the energy of the mitochondria due to those high stress states, shouldn't we actually need more energy to recover that stress state?
From the perspective of like it being a fuel management system, maybe not. And that's so say for example with dehydration, that's a signal that we like if we go into the wild, that's a signal that there isn't enough water, right? Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that if glycogen stores 3 grams of water for every gram of glucose, then it's like, why wouldn't we want to try to upregulate as much of that water weight as possible? Like, so just give the body the ability to store more fat, which holds water, store more glycogen, which holds water, so that we can kind of survive that little bit of dehydration. Mm-hmm. And so like in hypoxia, if we look at it from a perspective of like maybe being at a high altitude environment, or under the ground, like naked mole rats are an interesting topic on this because they live under the ground, and basically because they have low access to oxygen, they trigger fructose endogenously, and that enables their cells to continue working without having to rely on too much oxygen. So it's like if we look closely enough, they all map to a survival mechanism at the root. And it even makes sense why even hypertension fits into that. Because so if high osmolality, you got salty blood, you would want that. We didn't talk about this, but nitric oxide is also crippled within the cell during that whole process. So when fructose is metabolized and the uric acid is the end product, nitric oxide is also kind of downregulated. And so that is important for endothelial cells to remain flexible. And so when that comes down, it makes sense why if your blood is thick, that you want to tighten those walls up so that you can maintain blood flow. Again, adaptive short-term, but maladaptive long-term.
Oh man, this is so fantastic. Like, I'm loving how, like, even, you know, I've been in the weight loss world or the gut health world or the, you know, the natural health world for a long time and, you know, most of my adult life, basically. And even I'm having like these moments in the couple of times we've talked and listening to you just being like, it all makes sense. Oh my God.
Right. I know, right? And that's the thing is like, it feels like we're like so, and that's what I love about this is it doesn't change anything we already know. Like we need to get exercise. We need to get sleep. We should be eating whole foods. We should be reducing our sugar. We shouldn't drink too much. Like pick a thing, like pick any one of the strategies that we've like been experimenting with for decades. They all map onto this. But all this does is it zooms out and it says that actually a lot of what's happening here is that they're all mapping to fructose. Fructose is stressing your cell and basically working as the dial on your metabolism. And so if you turn your metabolism way down, of course you're going to start gaining weight. Of course you're going to start eating more because you're not getting as much of that fuel that you need. Your body is performing in a slow state. And if you continue on that road, of course disease is going to start emerging out of it. It sucks. It's like, but it maps out.
Before we dive into talking about luteolin and the work that you've done to be able to help people solve this problem, I have a question which actually comes from my partner, Yali. Because when I first met Yali, she had been a vegetarian for a long time. She ate a lot of fruit. And she asked the question. I convinced her to start eating steak when we decided we wanted to have a baby. But the question she had is somebody that loves fruit, that feels good when she starts the day. I start the day with steak. She prefers to start it with fruit. And her question was, so she's of Sri Lankan origin. She said, what about people that are from tropical islands where winter or tropical locations where winter doesn't come? Is there like where winter actually doesn't happen? You know, because if we go along this idea of like we're all eating for winter, but winter doesn't come, like because we're manufactured our lives like that. But what about those people that, and she's fortunate, she's also got fantastic genetics. She can eat anything and remain tall and stick thin and whatnot. But I wondered that too, because yeah, like, is there a genetic difference in the people that are more closely aligned to the center of the globe? You know, they've got, whether it be the Caribbean, whether it be places like Sri Lanka or like, yeah, what are your thoughts on that idea? Because she loves fruit, craves it. And, you know, there's, from that standpoint, I mean, as you said, in whole fruit, whole real food fruit, there's not tons of fructose, but she also, you know, can eat all sorts of terrible food and still nothing changes for her. So yeah, just your perspective on that.
That's a really good question. And I don't think there's been any research done on like demographics there to see if we've got differences too much. I mean, like we've got like, because this is pretty early, really. Like we think of, so like, why do these different blue zones have a higher longevity and stuff like that? And it sort of makes sense why, okay, some of these places, they eat local, like locavore kind of a thing. They eat whatever grows. And they have less access to processed food. So maybe that kind of maps out. But I've also, the interesting part of this is that I've noticed that there's certain demographics that seem to remain very thin, but also are starting to show signs of metabolic dysfunction.
Yeah.
And I worry about that. It's like the skinny fat phenomenon, right? Where it's like super thin still, but we don't really have any strong muscle tone. And actually, you do have a fatty liver and there's problems there. So I believe that this model explains that as well. And I'm not suggesting that's what's happening here, but I mean, maybe some of these things play in where if you think about it, your mitochondria are crushed. You're probably sending a signal of starvation. But what happens if you don't listen to that? What happens if you remain caloric restricted, even though you're kind of getting this self-reinforcing thing? So then basically, if your diet is restricted in calories, but still not of a really excellent origin, then you're still going to end up with that kind of weak mitochondrial cell. You may still end up with lipogenesis happening from the fructose, but you may not be, it may be localized. It might just be in the liver where the first place where this starts cascading rather than like subcutaneous fat and stuff like that. So it's like you basically, the visceral fat might still be there, but not the rest. And so like some of the research basically shows this quite specifically where it's like fructose itself drives all of the signals of metabolic syndrome without obesity. Doesn't matter. It explains why obesity develops if you allow it to, but it doesn't necessarily require it.
In a way, like the Lansdowne men, including myself, we don't really gain body fat. And over the years, people have said like, oh, you know, lucky you. And I've sort of said, well, in a way, it's not good because we have no signs of deterioration until cancer or until horrific outcomes. So at least if the body responded to the terrible diet, I'd be like, oh, probably should make some changes. But instead, it's like we get way too far down the garden path. And my grandfather and my uncle and my dad have all had experiences. You know, I'm fortunate that I got into this world at a much younger age. But yeah, it's like, you know, the skinny fat thing is maybe a bit of a curse sometimes too.
Yeah, because you don't know what's happening for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Totally. No indicators. So how do we fix this? Like, you know, like talk about luteolin, talk about what you've been doing. Yeah, the background behind that and how you came to create what you've created.
Sure. So this was all kind of simmering in the background. I did a bunch of research a few years ago now, and it was like, wow, that's really interesting. I have no idea what to do about this. And it was like, okay, I can take a few things to try to stimulate my mitochondria, try and reduce my intake of fructose, stuff like that. But it felt like a losing battle. It was challenging. I mean, like vitamin C is fantastic. EGCG I was taking for a while to see if I could kind of stimulate mitochondrial function a little bit. But it was like I knew that there was an enzyme that was the control mechanism, but I didn't know if anything could touch it. Until a few years later, I came across some research showing that there are some polyphenols that actually do work to inhibit fructokinase. So what that means then is that wherever that fructose is coming from, whether it's from your food or whether it's endogenously produced, whatever it might happen to be, if you don't have fructokinase, then you cannot create that cascade that ends up in uric acid and a mitochondrial stress. And so it's this great little linchpin that sits exactly where you want it to. And what's really amazing is that there's also a natural experiment that exists where humans are born without that enzyme. And they live very happy, healthy lives and do not develop metabolic syndrome. They have no idea that they have this little genetic mutation where they don't have fructokinase. They're just fine until it shows up on a test. And it's like, huh, that's neat. So basically, it kind of proves to us that this is a targetable mechanism. And if we don't have fructokinase, or if we downregulate it somehow, if we influence it somehow, then we will basically protect ourselves from the effects of fructose so that at that point, our cells can start naturally rebuilding themselves as they always will. You can then all of those rebuilding things that we do all the time start to make more sense. Like we take supplements after supplements and trying to add to a system because there's a deficiency. But we never are getting rid of the source of the issue if fructose really is the big elephant in the room. And so all that rebuilding work is just going to work so much better because you've cut out the fructose. And so really, that's where this got really amazing because, okay, we identified that there are polyphenols that start to influence fructokinase.
Yeah, that's so incredible. I'm curious, like when you say influence the fructokinase, so that means the fructose is going into the system or being endogenously produced. What's the downstream impacts of that, like the stopping it or blocking it?
That's a good question.
Yeah, because I always think like, you know, drugs have side effects, supplements have, you know, effects in other directions. So like, because it's currently operating as a survival function. And so, you know, based on what we've talked about, people might hear, well, if we're removing a survival function, is that a risk?
Isn't that a bad thing? Yeah, exactly. Good question. So Pfizer, 2019, I believe, they ran a trial on a fructokinase inhibitor and it had great results. I think everyone dropped in the range of 22% body fat, liver fat. So it moved the needle. And I couldn't figure out why they didn't bring it to phase three for a long time. I was like, this looks great. And they made it sound like a business decision. But more recently, I discovered that it worked too well. So basically, it started limiting a different enzyme. I forget the name of it off the top of my head. There's a T in there. But effectively, the backup system of how your body gets rid of fructose, they broke it. So they hit it too hard And then what started happening was glycogen started being kind of on a runaway almost, where it's like they started adding too much glycogen into their body. And it was like, okay, they said it was safe, everything was safe, but looking closer, it was like this probably wasn't as effective as they were hoping. So an interesting kind of thing there. But as far as I can tell, lutealin has no evidence of that. So basically what it's doing is it blocks fructokinase, but then your body uses these other kind of subsystems to just clear out the waste. And that's why that benign genetic condition was called essential fructosuria. So they were peeing out fructose. They had fructose in their urine, and that's how they identified it. So basically that it's this positive signal where it's like your body can get rid of it even when you don't have this enzyme.
Yeah.
And all the problems are kind of taken away upstream. So.
Yeah. A drug or a compound that works too well for a company like Pfizer probably is a business decision. We don't want people to get too well.
Who knows, right?
But my random theories aside, I guess the other thing that I'm wondering is, like, you know, this, the luteolin that you're talking about, you know, it's not a drug. Where does it come from? Where do we find it? Like, what is it in?
It is in so many of the foods we eat, just in small doses. It's in thyme, parsley, celery leaves, wild artichokes. Oh, I can't remember. There's tons. And so it is, it's not in high doses, like just a tiny trace amount, essentially. And what's interesting is that the body actually, it doesn't get through to your cells very easily either. It has a low bioavailability. And mm-hmm. So even though there are thousands of studies on it in medical journals, it's something that most consumers have never heard of. And it's sad. I'd love to see that change, because it sounds like this is a really cool strategy for targeting the effects of fructose. So liposomes change this. Liposomes are when you kind of add a little tiny pocket of fat around the molecule so that it can basically survive the digestive system and make it to your bloodstream, to your cells. And they basically found that the raw luteolin is in the range of like 7% bioavailable, even when you start pairing it with like other things, like I think rutin is often paired with it, which I think what that does is it's basically, it like binds to it and it slows how your digestive system handles it. So, but in the end, it doesn't actually change the bioavailability in your cell. So it just stretches out its effect rather than increases the bioavailability. So in the range of 7%, but then when you add liposomes, you can hit as high as 80%. So suddenly you have a very strong influence on what's happening inside your cell.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. Yeah, the liposomal technology has transformed the supplement industry totally, in many ways.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah, amazing. And I guess the question, like, people are obviously listening and this conversation thinking like, oh my God, I need to get my hands on this kind of stuff. And I've got one here to be able to show people on camera as well, which you've sent over. Where can people find them?
Our company is Live3 Health, so LIV3Health.com. And yeah, this is our only product right now because we kind of think everything maps to this. So basically we're trying to make it as effective and easy as possible to make part of your life, because such that the half-life is that, like, it's something that you probably want to take with meals, because that's going to be the biggest trigger of fructose. Of course, hypoxia, sleeping might be another kind of thing, but besides the fact, but it's like, if you can interrupt that fructose signal, then you can begin to recover. And so, like, what we're seeing anecdotally is that within, sometimes people say, hey, I feel great after like a couple of days, but most people in the range of like 3 weeks or so, they start to notice that their cravings drop significantly, where that food noise starts to disappear. And right around that same time, they start feeling much, much more energy. And those effects basically cascade over the next number of months. And because the cravings drop off, their caloric intake starts dropping off, and then their weight starts dropping as well. So like myself, I think I lost like 20, 25 pounds within the first 4 months or something without doing anything else. It was just like, and I felt fantastic. It was like, because my body had energy, I was sleeping better, just everything just sort of ran better. And it's really interesting because those reports absolutely mirror when someone successfully cuts out sugar from their life. Like when they really hardline that restriction and they cut it out, like maybe they miss it. Maybe they cut out the sugar, but they still eat pasta like wild or whatever it might happen to be. But it actually, like, it's very similar. It's like the inflammation goes down, your skin gets less blotchy, the puffiness around the middle, it's all the same. So I'm excited because it's just a sign that it seems to be pulling on the same lever.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious as well. Do you think it's like, is it a temporary solution or is it something that needs to be taken every day forever?
That's a good question. I believe that someone like Dr. Lustig will suggest that we need to do all these regulations to change our food system. We have too much sugar. We need to like litigate and get rid of it. There are so many things that like, there are so many suggestions there. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I think that we're stuck with the food system that we have because we wanted it. Right? Like we have sweet foods because we could make them. We could eat them. Like it's like biology is driving all of this. It's not, there's no cabal of like evil people that are trying to like fill us full of sugar. Like it's more likely our grandma that just wants to bake us a cake because she loves us. Right. It's like, so I don't think that our food system is going to change that radically, but if we can turn off the food noise, then maybe we'll just be less inclined to it. Like for example, like after a few months, my taste changed where it's like fruit is phenomenal. Like it just tastes like you would hope it would. And a lot of the times I'll go and eat something like cake and it's like, ugh, like the sweet gets too sweet. And so there's like this like subtle little shift that happens where just not as interested in sugar as you once were. It's not even just like an agency thing where it's like, I don't want it or like I can choose not to have it, but it's like, just doesn't have the appeal. So it's exciting that way. Just to answer your question though, I do think it's probably something that we're stuck with because our food system is something we're stuck with. But that said, my personal opinion is that a lot of the cascading problems that we see will stop being so much of a problem. I think that how do I put this? If chronic disease emerges out of this poor functioning cell, then theoretically, if you restore the function of that cell and you treat the disease with all the stuff we have already, then maybe that treatment can end because you restored actually the original function. And for that reason, like maybe the GLP-1 is something you can stop taking because you've lost the weight and now your cells are working again. So you're not going to start like consuming. You've kind of gotten off that train. My own father-in-law stopped taking Ozempic now because he's still losing weight. It's crazy. So yeah, but I think that it's exciting to kind of hypothesize of where this could go. I don't think that this is something that we'll want to stop taking, but I'm hoping that some of the more major treatments are things that we will eventually see that we don't need anymore. It's my hope.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, I'll put a link down in the show notes below for people to get their hands on this. And I too am about to dive into experimenting with this. So by the time this episode is live, I might be way skinnier. Not that I need to lose much weight.
You don't need it. Hopefully feel good. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That's the bit I'm interested in for myself, really. And Yali will probably have an experiment too. And it's like, it's just, yeah, that mitochondrial function returning. Like I'm excited about that idea of like, the energy that, because I think I've heard you talk about it before, like people feel like they've got another gear that they could switch into, but they just can't get there. And I totally relate to that. Although we do have a baby in the house and that's significantly hampering my sleep.
It does. Oh my goodness, for sure.
Okay, so before we wrap up, I would love to do our little Real Talk segment with you. So if you're up for that, I've got a handful of questions. We're going to go back and forth quite quickly and see what happens.
Sure.
Amazing. All right, so we've got question one. What's something that you believed 10 years ago that now makes you laugh?
I think the Atkins diet was something that I thought was ridiculous like 10 years ago, because it was like, I remember some people like an old grandma I know that was only eating steak and eggs and butter and everything else. And I thought, oh my goodness, she's going to die of a heart attack. And now like understanding the role of like proteins and carbs and everything, and like seeing how the carnivore diet can help people and all that. And like, I'm not suggesting that's for everybody. It's like, oh, I get it now. So it's just crazy how like, as we dig deeper into this and we start to understand the real functions, it's, yeah, the veil lifts a lot. So that's what I would say there.
All right. Next one is, what's one habit you'd be embarrassed to admit that you still have?
That I still eat sugar, probably. That it's like, mm-hmm. I think like knowing that fructose is by quite possibly the amplifier of like all chronic disease, that I am not afraid of it anymore. That it's like, I feel good, and I know that I've experimented enough to know that my body is actually controlling it. And it's like, I don't fear it anymore, but I'm also not like, it's like I moderate it naturally, and it's a great place to be in. Like my diet is fairly just even. I feel good. So I'm happy about that.
What's one supplement, habit, or wellness trend that you think is overhyped?
This might sound funny, but I think all of them. And I will explain. Because I think now that I zoomed out and I see the map, every one of them is important, but they pull a tiny lever. And it's like, okay, that's great. You keep pulling all those levers. We're going to be at it for 100 years trying to hit every little thing, whether it's every little source of fructose, whether it is like, of course, good sleep is important and exercise. Like all of those things are important. All the supplements, they do add to a system, but nothing comes close to relieving the source of the problem. It's like, I like this metaphor of, it's like, why do you spend all this time mopping your floor when you don't take off your muddy boots every time you come in the door? Like, we have to get rid of the source of the stress, and then all of that other stuff just becomes much more interesting and much more valuable.
What's a rabbit hole topic that you think more people should explore?
Fructose metabolism, like straight up. Because we could have talked for 10 hours on here, because this maps to Alzheimer's disease with endogenous fructose in the brain. There's like complete pathology of like why it would develop, what the motivation is behind it, how it develops. And in mice, they have actually mapped it out where fructose will induce Alzheimer's by 18 weeks. It's like it's cancer with the Warburg effect, because our cells can't handle the proper energy metabolism. And so by repairing that energy metabolism, which is the only target for metastatic cancer, then it will theoretically apply there too. So it's like every single different kind of health thing tracks back to this. And it is such a cool rabbit hole to dig down into, especially when you realize that you don't have to be afraid of it, but it's actually there with purpose. We just have to understand it.
Yeah, I can relate to that. And I'm only 1 week in.
Yeah.
All right, the next one is, in 20 years from now, what do you want to be known for?
I'm just happy to be part of this conversation, but I would love to shine a light on this map, because I feel like it is a very exciting map of just all of metabolic health. It reframes everything, and it doesn't invalidate anything in the process. It just it validates those theories, whether it's caloric, insulin, whatever it might happen to be, and it kind of shows where they fail, where it's like they work to a point and then they don't get any further. So I think I'd love to be part of shining a light on the map.
And finally, if everything you've ever said was deleted, what's one sentence that you'd want to leave people with?
Fructose metabolism is very likely the amplifier of chronic disease that has tipped us into the metabolic epidemic. And we need to change our perspectives there and dig much deeper into it and do way more research on it so that we can actually either invalidate this whole thesis or solve metabolic health.
Mic drop. Boom. Thanks for being here, Chris. That was awesome, man.
Thank you.
I'm excited to get this episode out to people. I think people's brains are going to melt and they're going to be very excited to try the Sugar Shield. And I think you're doing great work. And yeah, let's do 10 hours worth of podcasting over 10 episodes though.
Yeah. I'm happy to come back if it's helpful. It's exciting. Yeah. I love this stuff. It's funny. I'm like been nerding out for like, I don't know, 4 years on this stuff. And it's like every day, like last night, it was like 3 a.m. and I like had a little moment of restlessness and I picked up my phone. I looked up and there was this new study that went about alcohol. And I was like, oh my goodness, now I'm up all night. It's just like, and that's the crazy thing is like day after day, there's like confirmation signals that come through even when they don't know it. They're like, it's just like everything maps to this so seamlessly. It's just exciting. Exciting to be part of it. So
amazing. Well, thanks for being on the show and we'll catch up really soon.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. Thank you so much. It was great.
So welcome.
Awesome.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.